We actually discussed the fact that TCU did win this weekend, so.
And the other discussion was that made the record 61-41. 61-21, and 40 more victories, they'll catch up.
All right, so let's get started again. Both sides ready? All right, would you call the case, please?
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Scott Hastings, here with my co-counsel, Marshall Searcy, on behalf of Tom McCoy. Mr. McCoy filed this lawsuit seeking to enforce a deal he had made with Alden Industries, a company that he had worked for many years. Mr. McCoy made the deal started discussions back in 2007, but the deal really takes shape in 2008. When Mr. McCoy was looking for an opportunity to step back and retire, was considering options, he was the majority shareholder and the CEO of the company, and was considering options of how to go about doing this, which included selling to third parties, private equity, other companies, but he was approached by Alden's current management, and management wanted to stay in control of the company. It's a company that historically had been owned by management. And so he listened and ultimately negotiated a deal with Alden's current management, Craig Adams, Steve Utes on the board of directors. And that's the deal that we're here about, is the deal that was negotiated among these parties along with lenders that was supposed to allow Mr. McCoy to step back and turn over control to Alden's current management. In particular, one of the key terms we're seeking to enforce is an insurance-funded redemption provision. But to put this in perspective, I'd like just to talk a little bit about how the deal came together, because it's very important in this case. This was a complex deal, multi-million dollar transaction, lenders involved, mezzanine lenders involved. The shareholders all had to approve the transaction because there was voting trusts involved, a very complex transaction. So the parties put together a term sheet to outline the essential terms and the material terms of their business deal. The insurance-funded redemption is one of those terms. Your Honors, that term sheet was attached to a letter to the shareholders. It's in the record in many places, and it's also behind tab 9 of our brief. What's significant about that term sheet, if you look at tab 10, is every shareholder of the company approved it. The evidence is also undisputed that that term sheet was not only prepared by Mr. McCoy, it was also prepared by Craig Adams, then the president of the company, now the CEO of the company. Steve Utes was involved before and after he was a member of the board of directors. Merit Capital, who helped provide the financing for the transaction, had the opportunity to comment on the term sheet. The point is, that was the deal. Everyone got together and said, this is the deal we're going to go forward and do. And it's a term from that term sheet that we're seeking to enforce. The evidence is also undisputed that after all the shareholders signed this, the parties move forward. If the court were to go down the term sheet and start looking item by item, first paragraph talks about the purpose of the deal, but then after that it starts talking about events that would occur, such as the lending, such as the voting trust, the idea that Mr. Adams would become the CEO of the company, and he'd become a member of the board. If you go down that list, there's a lot of terms. Every single one of those terms, except one, was performed. The one that was not is the insurance-funded redemption under which this lawsuit's about. Your Honors, after a dispute arose, my client filed this lawsuit because at a minimum, when the parties all agreed on the deal, the terms from that June 2 letter that were approved by the shareholders became a fully binding deal on the parties. They all agreed on the terms, and when they started going forward performing parts of the deal, getting the lending, signing up the voting trust to allow Mr. Adams, the current CEO, to now control a majority of the shares. When they started performing all of those deals, they couldn't just stop after performing 90% of them, 9 out of 10 or whatever the number is, and say, I'm sorry, Tom, we decided we don't want to give you that insurance-funded redemption That was part of what was promised to you to get you to go forward with this deal. When the district court entered summary judgment against Mr. McCoy and his claims, it's our contention that the evidence actually was undisputed the other direction. At a minimum, there was a deal, and then there's a question as to all the terms of that deal, which I'm going to get to in just a second. The important point, though, just to foreshadow this, is there's a line of cases in Texas law. Foreca, cited in our brief, is one. The City of Colony case from this court recognizes it, that the parties can have a fully binding deal if they have the essential terms agreed upon, even though there may be details that have to be worked out later. That's our situation. Mr. McCoy would not have gone forward with all the other terms in the deal and turned over the control of the company that he was the CEO and majority shareholder of without getting his full return on the deal. And there were details that were going to get worked out later. They did anticipate that there would be a formal written document at the later date, but that still doesn't change the fact that under the law, there was a binding deal under the original term sheets. And there's actually no evidence to dispute the parts I've just said. Summary judgment should not have been granted to Alden. It should have been granted to Mr. McCoy. Your Honors, with respect to the deal, after the parties went forward, after they started this transaction, after they started closing, signing up the voting trust, signing up the other provisions, they did start working on a written document to fill in the rest of the details. Again, that was an issue before the district court, and the evidence does not support the district court's summary judgment. The district judge found on summary judgment that there was no disputes of fact and that the agreement, the written agreement, was never agreed upon by the parties. But here's the evidence that was in there about the agreement. First, there was an agreement drafted by the company lawyer, Phil McCrory. Mr. McCrory circulated that agreement. His original circulation asked and said circulating it for signature, but then Mr. McCoy commented, so he circulated a second draft. July 21, 2008, no dispute, a written document was prepared. It's also undisputed that before 2009, the end of 2009, over a year later, the July 21, 2008 agreement is the agreement. There was no competing draft floating around. There weren't comments floating around in writing. That was the document. July 22 of 2008, there was a board meeting. Mr. McCoy was at the meeting. His testimony was that the agreement was brought up and the board approved the pending agreements. That alone should have been enough to defeat the summary judgment from Alden. But there's more. The board minutes themselves say that in other business, it's the last item, number 10, on the board of directors minutes, which is also on a tab to our appellant's brief. In other business, the board approved the pending stock redemption agreements. There was only one document that had been circulated or that was in circulation at that time. There's no competing document as to what else that could possibly mean. So there's at least enough evidence to have survived summary judgment. But after that, it continued. In August, Mr. McCrory, the company lawyer, who's the secretary of the company as well, he prepared the minutes. He sent the agreement, the same one we were seeking to enforce, with all the details, filling out the June 2008 terms. He sent that document to Craig Adams, now the CEO, because at that same board meeting where the agreement was approved, Mr. McCoy stepped down. He honored his part of the agreement. He stepped down as CEO, and Mr. Adams became the CEO of the company. So in August, the agreement is sent on to Mr. Adams. Mr. McCrory's email says, print three copies and bring them to my office. Mr. McCrory is a corporate lawyer, and when a corporate lawyer tells someone to print three copies, there's a reason for it. The reasonable inference is that those are signature copies. The document was final and ready to be signed. Your Honors, that is substantial evidence to undermine the district court's conclusion. The district court heard one bit of evidence to the contrary. Steve Utes, a board member, submitted an affidavit in this case. Mr. Utes' affidavit says that on the morning of that board meeting, he and Mr. McCoy had a conversation, and according to Mr. Utes, they were discussing other terms that were not in that written document. That is Mr. Utes' testimony. And unfortunately, if that testimony didn't exist, I would be here saying that the court also needs to enter a judgment in McCoy's favor enforcing the July 28 term sheet as well. But there is at least some evidence to the contrary. But what's wrong with the district court's order is that on summary judgment, you don't go with the one person's memory of the event when there's a substantial weight of evidence against it. And the problem the district court's order does is essentially gives credit to one side of the story and ignores the rest.
Was there a subsequent written agreement that
Your
was
Honor,
signed?
Your Honor, there was, but I want to be clear about what that agreement was. There was never a long-term subsequent agreement signed. And actually, the next point I was going to run to was to talk about the short-term agreements that were later signed, because that is an important part of this case and discussed in our briefs. What happened is, after July of 2008, there is a long period of silence. The evidence actually shows that these agreements were very important to Mr. McCoy, and they were very important to Craig Adams as well, because he was getting a similar deal on insurance-funded redemption. And when the issue arose over a year later, Mr. McCoy was surprised when somebody said, "Did you realize we didn't have a deal and didn't finish up our deal and sign up the document?" McCoy's testimony is he was surprised. Mr. Adams' testimony is when he heard this, he was in the car, and he said he wanted to pull over and walk home. This affected him, too. He thought the deal was done as well. That's all the objective evidence here, and when you're looking at the deal to see if it's done, you look at what the parties were doing at the time. Everyone back in 2008 when the deal was being closed thought the deal was done until 2009 when someone raises a complaint. Now, a lot happened between 2008 and 2009, and I'm sure this court has seen a lot of the fallout from the way the economy turned, all kinds of financial issues arose. A lot happened between July of 2008 and the fall of 2009. So when this issue arose, what Mr. McCoy found was instead of the people ready just to sign up the rest of the deal or try to get this done, he was faced with people who wanted to retrade the deal that they had agreed to, that McCoy agreed to when he turned over control of the company. So significant financial circumstances changed. And so the company was looking for a way out. In 2009, the company presented him with a short-term deal, 3 months. It's interim redemption agreements, the way we've referred to it. But at the time, there was a dispute between the parties, and the dispute centered on a term, stock transfer restrictions. Because at some point, someone after June of 2008 decided they wanted more stock transfer restrictions on the deal related to this insurance funding redemption. And so in 2009, when they're discussing it, one of the holdups the parties had was they couldn't agree on what that detail would be. It's like the Fereca case. You had the main deal, and then when they're trying to paper the deal at the end, somebody's raising a complaint about a term no one thought was material enough at the beginning to say, hold up the deal. And so they have a disagreement. And so while the parties are negotiating and discussing their disagreements, with the threat hanging over Mr. McCoy's head of, you don't agree to something with us, we're just going to try to walk away from our entire deal, which clearly was not an appropriate course given that they had already performed 90% of the original transaction, Mr. McCoy signed a short-term deal agreeing to Alden's proposed terms on transfer restrictions for a period of 3 months. Alden is trying to use that document as a gotcha to say, Mr. McCoy, you just waived all your complaints. What they're trying to say is, because Mr. McCoy agreed for a short period of just 3 months to agree to one of Alden's details from the document, the benefit McCoy received in return for that is he lost the rest of his deal that he agreed in June of 2008. Your Honor, there's no consideration to support a deal like that. We've cited the McCollum case from the Fifth Circuit, which is a good example. Asking someone to honor the deals that they already made is not consideration. Alden's trying to perform less than the deal that they originally made under those short-term deals to get out of the deal on a long-term basis.
In the second agreement, did it have a provision that it superseded the previous agreement?
Your Honor, it did. And that provision, because the agreement is not supported by consideration, that provision goes by the wayside as well. It's important. That's why I'm discussing consideration, because Mr. McCoy was receiving no consideration for that deal, and if the agreement's not supported by consideration, that agreement's as if it never even happened. Your Honor, my time's almost up. I want to briefly touch on our second claim relating to McCoy's compensation. It's as simple as this. In the subordinated loan agreement, paragraph 6.7, Mr. McCoy was lending money back to the company. He's a lender. He also, as part of the deal, continued as a director. Paragraph 6.7 said the company could not enter into or amend an agreement with a director without the lender's consent. So you can't change the director's deal without McCoy's consent. After this issue arose, we believe in an effort to essentially bully or punish Mr. McCoy into going along with the changes Alden was proposing, the company said, if you don't do this, we're going to slash your compensation. And when Mr. McCoy wouldn't go along and agree to a different deal, his compensation got slashed without his permission, which is contrary to paragraph 6.7. Your Honor, I see my time is up. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to address them. If not, great. Thank you, Your Honors.
Elizabeth?
Please the court. I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I'm here with co-counsel Mr. Friedman, and also on the brief is Ms. Priscilla from Haynes and Boone. Of course, we represent Alden Industries in this case. This is a summary judgment case that involves whether an enforceable contract can exist when the party who is arguing for that contract concedes that material terms were either left out or weren't even thought about at the time. Now, Mr. Hastings referred to the line of cases that says that, yes, you can have an agreement that's going to be papered later. And that's true, but he also said what's really critical about that, and that is if they have the essential terms agreed upon. And that is why that lack of essential agreement, for example, in a case like the Playoff Corporation versus Blackwell, that Justice Doveno, you were on the panel a few years ago on that one, that case could have been tailor-made for this one, because at issue there is whether you can have an agreement to agree or whether you had some binding agreement that was what Mr. Blackwell pushed for, of course. And this court very clearly said that if a court can't tell what the terms are, then it is nothing more than an agreement to agree. And we would submit that that's exactly what evidence in this case showed and why Judge Evans was exactly right in granting summary judgment to Alden and denying Mr. McCoy's summary judgment motion. Now, recall, and of course Mr. Hastings said this, what Mr. McCoy was arguing for was one comprehensive agreement that was reached in all its material terms, according to him, by the time of a term sheet that was circulated to shareholders on June 2nd of 2008. Now, when we look at that term sheet, and I'll go through it in some detail in a moment, when we look at it, we'll see that it's obviously directed toward the refinancing. In other words, Mr. McCoy wanted to get $35 million for a little more than half the stock he owned in Alden. He was a 60% shareholder before June of 2008, even though an independent valuation had showed that all of his stock was worth $24 million. But regardless, the deal was going to be what it was going to be. He was also the CEO and chairman of the board at that time. Excuse me. So the vast reams of paper that accompanied that transaction and that Mr. McCrory assisted with were papers that went toward the loans that had to be taken out so that Alden would have the money available to pay Mr. McCoy for a little over half of his stock. And it was lender agreements, it was mezzanine debt agreements, it was corporate governance agreements and all of that. But what is apparent is that the parties decided to do that first and then wait after that closed and deal with the idea of an insurance-funded redemption for the balance of Mr. McCoy's shares. It's clear, Alden does not deny that the parties were going to be working toward an agreement of that sort, but it was certainly not in place by June 2nd or even June 9th, the closing of the purchase of 2008. Now, the other part that Mr. McCoy says was the third part of this comprehensive agreement was, of course, his compensation. He says that there was an indefinite agreement where he would get $250,000 a year for being on a board that met four times a year and would also get a car and insurance and other sorts of things. There hasn't been very much in the discussion or the briefing about that for some reason. That there's nothing that shows that an agreement like that ever existed. Mr. McCoy couldn't even testify that there was a discussion about that at any particular time. He just thinks, well, it was done sometime before. And that sort of comes to the crux of this whole case. Mr. McCoy could not identify when, with whom, where, or exactly what was agreed upon before June 9th of 2008 as far as the insurance-funded redemption agreement. And it's very important also to note that he does not say that there were any additional oral terms of that. He says we can look at the term sheet and see exactly what the obligations were. And, of course, the test for a binding and enforceable contract is whether a court can look at something like this one sentence in a term sheet and determine what the party's legal obligations would be. Now, in that term sheet, and it's at tab 9 of the appellant's appendix, and it's attached, of course, to the June 2nd letter to the shareholders, which, by the way, in the letter that Mr. McCoy signed, talks about nothing more than the value of his stock buyback, the $35 million that he was getting, and the lender agreements and the warrants that he was going to have and how those would be valued. The letter itself says not one single word about a stock repurchase agreement funded by insurance when he died or about any compensation agreement. And in fact, if you look at the very first box of the term sheet itself, the purpose is defined right there as a transaction in which McCoy's going to sell 1,400 shares of his stock and he's going to get $35 million. And after that, management will own a certain percent, et cetera. Nothing there in the purpose of the term sheet to clue the shareholders in that, according to Mr. McCoy, the company was also going to be binding itself somehow to pay him $30 million or his estate $30 million when he died, regardless of how many shares he was left with, or anything like that. The only reference to the stock buyback insurance concept, which again was the agreement to agree at most, appears on the very last part of the term sheet. And there it simply says the company will have life insurance on McCoy. Now, the will have right there raises a question. What the whole board did not know, and what Mr. Utes testified that he did not know, was that Mr. McCoy had gone out in 2007 using Alden money without telling the board, and bought $30 million of life insurance on himself before this deal was close to being finalized. So even Mr. Utes on the board would have looked at that, okay, the company will have, and Mr. Utes thought, okay, we're going to need to go acquire insurance for Mr. McCoy, but when is this going to happen? Not sure. Life insurance, what kind of insurance? Term insurance, whole life, variable, who knows? It's not spelled out. On McCoy, who's going to be...
Was there also $22 million in insurance purchased on the life of Mr. Adams at the same time?
That was not purchased, no, not at the same time that Mr. McCoy...
Later.
That was later. That was later, Your Honor, yes. We don't know who exactly the beneficiary of this life insurance is supposed to be. It's not spelled out there. That's obviously a key term when you're talking about having life insurance available. At a cost equal to the dollar amount of the respective coverage of all shares.
Well, doesn't it say Keyman Insurance? Or is that different? You're talking about the repurchase. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. The Keyman Insurance was something entirely different to protect the lender. But all shares, that's another important concept, because Mr. McCoy has been very clear that he was not going to agree to any restrictions on the transfer of his stock any time after closing. And when he died, he did not want to agree that he couldn't sell to a competitor. He testified quite clearly in his deposition that there were no restrictions he was prepared to agree to. So even under this term sheet, let's say that he had sold part of his stock before he died. Is Alden supposed to pay $30 million, even if he just had a few shares left? Is that what goes to his estate? And in fact, that is a term that Mr. McCoy himself in his deposition said, in hindsight, that was an obvious omission. Mr. McCoy was very forthcoming in his deposition. He candidly agreed that that was an obvious omission from what was being discussed at this time and what certainly what was in the term sheet. He also conceded in his deposition on the term sheet that there's nothing in there that says Alden is obligated to buy back the stock from Mr. McCoy's estate, whatever number of shares he died with, nor did it say that Mr. McCoy's estate would be obligated to sell its stock back to Alden. I suppose one can foresee a situation where the stock of Alden became incredibly more valuable. Maybe Mr. McCoy's heirs wouldn't have wanted to sell it back for $30 million. I mean, who knows? But the point is, there were material terms, obvious terms, that were not certainly not in the term sheet. And this is the piece of paper that Mr. McCoy points to as containing all the material terms of the deal. And that is just simply not the case. And even when you get to what happened before the board meeting in July, Mr. Utes testified, and it's important to note, too, that Mr. McCoy did not contradict this. He just said, I don't remember. But Mr. Utes testified very clearly that he and Mr. McCoy had a discussion the morning of the board meeting where Mr. Utes said, okay, this is what is going to need to be in our insurance-funded redemption agreement. And Mr. Utes testified that Mr. McCoy didn't have any trouble with it. There's also a note in the record, a contemporaneous note that Mr. Utes wrote, where he was summarizing his discussion with Mr. McCoy, and he put the restrictions that actually ended up in the interim agreements later, such as no sale to a competitor, no sale to anybody that would bust the company's subchapter S status. And Mr. Utes also included in that note, consider other terms for final agreement with a question mark. And when they went into the board meeting, Mr. McCoy wants to suggest that, well, the board approved it because there's something in the board minutes saying we approve the pending stock agreements. But Mr. McCoy himself admitted in deposition that the full board had never seen the draft that Mr. McCrory had circulated and the draft that Mr. Utes had informed Mr. McCrory was not complete because it didn't include any restrictions, transfer restrictions. Mr. McCoy admits that the full board didn't have it, and he even admitted that it was possible, as Mr. Utes and Mr. Adams testified, that he might have suggested to Mr. Utes that the board not even get into any details. Both Mr. Utes and Mr. Adams viewed it as a very brief discussion lasting 2 minutes at most, I believe, was the testimony, and with the idea clearly being that Mr. Utes was making a motion to go forward to work on getting a final agreement and acquiring the insurance that he even then did not know Mr. McCoy had already purchased. So the concept that there's anything about this board meeting that also approved any kind of writing or any kind of notion is just totally contradicted by the evidence. And then when we get to the discovery in 2009 that, in fact, nothing...
Kerr,
yes, sir.
By what you just said, isn't that a question of fact?
A question of fact as to whether the parties had an agreement? Oh, sorry.
Whether the parties at the time of the board meeting had all of the information.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that since Mr. McCoy has been very clear in his pleadings and in his briefing and even today that the agreement was reached by June of 2008, that's really the critical time to look at. But that even if you look at what happened later, that's, you know, in my mind, even further evidence that the parties had not reached an agreement and were still working on this agreement-to-agree concept.
We're arguing, aren't we discussing evidence as opposed to contradictory evidence that would cause a fact question to arise?
Your Honor, I don't think that question arises when you look at Mr. McCoy's own testimony. And if this were just Mr. Utes said one thing, Mr. McCoy denies it, or something like that, I might agree with you that there would be a fact question. But when you have Mr. McCoy himself admitting that there were material terms that hadn't been thought about or discussed or laid out in the term sheet, which he says contains all the terms, then I think that Judge Evans was absolutely right to find that as a matter of law, they had not agreed on the terms of an insurance-funded stock redemption agreement.
What did they agree on, if anything, in June of 2008?
In June of 2008, Your Honor, what they agreed on was that Alden would borrow a lot of money, and using that money, Mr. McCoy would get $35 million for part of his stock. That's what they, that was the transaction that was closed in June of 2008. And they agreed that they would then later see if they could come to some sort of terms on the insurance-funded redemption of the rest of his shares. And that is what the parties never came to an agreement on because Mr. McCoy.
Is it correct that the remaining shares that Mr. McCoy had was 900 and some shares?
I believe that that's right, Your Honor. And he also had a warrant to purchase some more.
940 shares, I'm thinking.
Yes, Your Honor. And there's also a warrant. And the warrant brings up an interesting ambiguity. Well, not ambiguity. That's not
well,
the right
I'm
word.
Not through. I don't want
I'm
you
sorry.
To leave. I don't want you to leave June of 08 yet. What actually was funded in June of 08, if anything?
What was funded was the buyout of Mr. McCoy's 1,400 shares.
How much money was he paid?
$35 million. He got $25 million in cash and $10 million in the form of mezzanine debt.
Your position and your client's position that he was given $35 million without an agreement?
No, that part of it was it had stacks of paper associated with it. No, Your Honor, that we are not arguing about that here today at all. That part closed. He got his $35 million.
But he wasn't, there wasn't an agreement on what would happen with the balance of his shares.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's the whole kicker in terms of the summary judgment is what we're dealing with. It's not the original purchase closing of a portion of his shares, but the $30 million that he is supposed to get for the other 940 plus warrant.
If the parties had ever been able to come to terms on how that was going to work, such as what happens if he sells some, are there going to be any restrictions attached to it, and all of those sorts of things.
Appreciate your answers.
Did you want to finish?
Yes, thank you very much, Your Honor. I would just like to conclude by reminding the court that Mr. McCoy's own words, I think, supports what Judge Evans decided on summary judgment. When he was asked point blank, was there ever a comprehensive discussion of this deal with the board before June of 2008? And he said, I don't think there ever was. He also says that there was no obligation in the term sheet for Alden to sell to buy the stock from his estate, nor was there an obligation in there for his estate to sell to Alden, things that he admitted were missing key terms from the term sheet. And finally, he says that when it came to the idea of what happens if you sell some stock before you die, in hindsight, that's an obvious omission. I think consistent with the Playoff Corporation case and all the other authorities that go into an agreement to agree, and the fact that if you don't have all material terms nailed down, then it is not an enforceable contract. And for that reason, summary judgment was proper. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you extend this time 2 minutes, please?
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to start with one, I guess, what I would call a structural issue before I get it really into the meat of the details here. And the structural point is this. The reason we've started with the June 2008 timeframe and term sheet is because we believe that agreement not only should not have been the subject of summary judgment for Alden, it should actually be enforced all the way the other direction because the evidence was undisputed in McCoy's favor. And so with that, anything going forward had to honor that original deal as the parties are dealing with the terms. The July 2008 agreement part is important as well, and I wanted to make sure that the structural point is not missed because we've spent a lot of time in our brief explaining why the June agreement had all the terms, and I think it does. But even if the court disagreed, we would still have to look at the July 2008 deal because if that agreement, if that was accepted by the parties, that itself is a binding deal. And so while I've discussed them together because they really flowed together, the original agreement with the details following later, both of which the facts support Mr. McCoy's position, for Alden to have won summary judgment, they would have had to win on both of those issues as a matter of law. I want to briefly start on the July 2008 part because I'd like to correct something about Mr. McCoy's testimony. And as I stated in my opening, what we think the district court did, or the order looks to have done, is to accept Mr. Ute's testimony in contrast to the documents and all the other more objective evidence of what was happening. But Mr. McCoy's testimony that you just heard some commentary about, when asked about the conversation with Steve Utes on the morning of the board meeting, he didn't say, I do not remember. And the record site to where to go look in the record is in, it is in Alden's brief. What Mr. McCoy actually said is, when asked, did this conversation occur, he said, not that I recall. I think I would have remembered this, and I do not remember this. So to the best of my knowledge, I don't think it occurred. That's a far cry from just an unequivocal, I don't know, or I don't remember. Mr. McCoy's testimony is consistent with all the documents, and Mr. Utes' testimony is not. There is also reference to Mr. Utes' handwritten note, a note that Mr. Utes admits is misdated. But then Alden's response brief really says it right. They call that note a tiebreaker. But if we're here on a summary judgment, there's nobody breaking a tie. That's for a jury to decide what would be the tiebreaker in a he said, she said dispute, as Alden says it. So that alone would be enough to have to reverse the summary judgment. I want to go now to the June 2008 agreement, which has been the focus of a lot of discussion. Your Honors, first of all, Alden's argument starts off in saying and tries to minimize the importance of the term of the insurance-funded redemption because there was a four-page document, or the first four pages of the document have two pages of text followed by two pages of term sheets, and the insurance-funded redemption is near the bottom. But I'm not aware of any principle of law that says when you're reading documents that you just ignore part of it because it's buried further down in the document. It's in that very document that Alden was discussing. Although the document talks about a lot of other parts, the terms we're seeking to enforce are in that document. Another presumption of law, and we've cited this in our reply brief in the America's Favorite Chicken case, the law's presumption is not to avoid deals or find negotiations to be unenforceable. The presumption is when people really have a deal, the presumption is to enforce the deal, not to let people out of it. Alden has not cited a single case similar to the fact pattern of this case, where you have a complex deal with many moving parts, and the parties are moving forward with all of the parts of the deal, and after you're 90% done, comes back and says, I changed my mind, I don't really want to give you everything I promised you at the beginning. That case is not existing under Texas law, I don't believe. We haven't found it. We've cited a lot of cases to the contrary. In terms of whether terms are essential, that's Alden's main excuse. On the June 2008 time period, they want to say, look at the document, it's missing essential terms. And in their briefing, they focus a lot on the stock transfer restrictions. The law is that looking at whether agreement has the essential terms is not done in hindsight. It's looking at what the parties thought at the time. This court in the City of Colony says it's not what was in the subjective minds of some of the parties. You look at the objective evidence of what was said and what was done. And what was done here is after the term sheet, the parties went forward closing the rest of the deal, which says they thought there was not missing something material. And as we explain in our brief, if there was concerns about stock transfer restrictions, they were actually handled under a different document, the corporate governance agreement. They already had provisions to protect Alden. Your Honor, a fair reading of the term sheet, yes, it's short on insurance funded redemption, but it starts with stock buyback insurance. It says in the discussion, it's talking about to fund the repurchase of shares. The idea that the way to read this to say that there's no obligations between the parties is to ignore the plain meaning of what this document is, what this says. That would be reading the document to render it invalid, whereas the presumption is this was intended to have some kind of meaning. And Mr. McCoy's interpretation is the only one that gives it meaning. So, Your Honors, I see my time is getting close here. I just want to finish with this thought. When you're looking at a contract and the parties are working together, they put together their terms, and they start to perform, the law is not that just because later, when you're 90% complete, and one party starts thinking after the fact, I wish I had addressed X, or gee, I wish I really had done Y. The law is not that if you can dream up something that you wish you had thought about at the time you did your deal, that you all of a sudden get out of the contract. If there was anything ambiguous about the contract, if there was anything that was open to interpretation, as long as the material elements are here, here the elements are, what was going to be done, buy back the shares. What shares were they? All of his shares, including his family interests. How is it going to be done? Through insurance. What was the price? $30 million. And when was to occur? Upon death. You have the essential terms, the idea that people can dream up additional terms later that they wish would be in the document doesn't void the deal that they had. Your Honors, thank you very much for your time. Unless there's anything further, I will yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. We do appreciate your argument today. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted.